House Committee on Revenue for March 10, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 611.
I'll sign it.
Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're going to do a kind of a panel discussion for background for you. This bill is involves centrally assessed properties, and we're going to ask Kyle and Department of Revenue to come up. We've got Mike Vaughn, who is the head of the Central Assessment Unit, DOR, along with Mark Garst, and they're going to describe, give you some background, which will give you some context for 611.
Great. Thank you. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, as Paul just mentioned, I think we're going to go ahead and start off. Department of Revenue is going to give a little background on current law of central assessment, so we have an idea of where it is that we're starting from. And then I can go, we'll switch back over, and I'll go through some of the bill changes and how those differ from the current law. And then we have Department of Revenue here for questions as well.
Chair Bonner, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Just in case you're curious, nothing's happened to John Phillips. He just decided that this would be a good time to take a 2-week trip to South Africa, so I get the to enjoy this this whole sit down today.
Is that far enough away?
I don't think he could go any further. So what I thought I'd do for you today is discuss the history of the Central Assessment Program a little bit to get a little bit of background and perspective. Forgive me if some of you may have heard some of this before. If you were in the interim committee, I think that some of this material may have been covered, but I think that there should still be, it's still always a good refresher. So just kind of how we got here. So central assessment began in the late 1800s. It was a result of difficulty in valuing rail networks that crossed county and state lines. The concern was that there would be inequities if each local assessor were to appraise their particular little part of the rail line that crossed. There was some concern that they might favor their part of the system more than, you know, that you would end up with a value that was greater than the whole. So the idea then moved to centrally assess these properties at the state level, and that's where the term central assessment comes from. There are two policy rationales, accuracy and consistency. It looks at the value of the operating unit, the whole company's value, all the property of the company, and then it breaks that down to the various states and then down to the various counties. The biggest difference is that between local assessment and central assessment is that central assessment includes intangible property, which is property that you can't touch necessarily. So that would include things like trademarks, patents, goodwill, which is the brand of the company. These are not picked up in local assessment, but they are picked up in central assessment. The idea was to capture the value of the integrated network beyond just that one little bit of rail or pipe that might go through the county in question. So to reflect the fact that the value of it isn't in that one little piece of pipe, the value is in the fact that you have this integrated network that functions as a whole and is able to deliver a service. Central assessment in Oregon began in 1909. Initially, it included rail, telegraph and telephone, power, water, gas companies, and a couple other utilities. In 1951, the legislature modified the law to focus more on the services that the companies provided as opposed to the companies themselves. And this was when we first saw the word communication enter the scene. It was telephone and telegraph communication companies. And that's really what Senate Bill 611, which we're looking at today, is focused on, is communication companies. The nature of these companies is that they have a high percentage of their value in these intangible assets compared to the tangible property. And that's what's kind of raised some interest. Initially, communication was limited to telephone and telegraph, but in 1973, there was a new microwave service that was like a point-to-point direct network that was being established in Oregon. And at that time, the legislature added data transmission services by whatever means provided. It wasn't until 2009 that we got around to removing the word telegraph, but we still have data transmission services by whatever means provided. In 2014, we got a picture of what this term really means when the Supreme Court took on the Comcast case and gave us a clear definition of what data transmission services are. So since 1973, as you're well aware, technological change has just been exponential. The business models have moved to where there's a blend between voice, telephone, internet, video, and the technologies have just expanded. We have cable, satellite, wireless, fiber. So the department has attempted to keep up with this challenge, these changes, and it's been a real challenge to say who should be and who should not be centrally assessed. The issue came to a head in 2006. The department determined that cable and internet services had broken the barrier and were at that time providing communication services. They were competing head-to-head with incumbent carriers. They matched, and they were no longer easily assessed locally. The department advised the legislature in this hearing room in August of 2006 that unless the legislature took action in the 2007 session, we would begin assessing cable internet service providers in the 2008 or 2009 tax years. There were several bills that attempted to address this issue. The law remained unchanged, however, and we began assessing Comcast in 2009, and that was quickly followed by the lawsuit. So the lawsuit first was in tax court. The tax court ruled for Comcast, but it accepted neither the department nor the company's interpretation, and both parties appealed. Oral arguments before the Supreme Court were in January of 2013, and the order was issued on October 2nd of 2014. The court found that Comcast was a communications company under the central assessment law, and the issue was not entirely decided. However, they remanded the case back to the tax court for some determinations about what the taxable value of the property was, and specifically that is revolving around what the maximum assessed value of the property should be. That decision created a very hurried discussion at the Department of Revenue, and Mike Vaughn is going to explain what happened at that point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Vaughn. I'm the valuation manager at the Oregon Department of Revenue, responsible for two programs, really, state industrial appraised property and central assessment valuation, which is what we're here to discuss. Central assessment is unique in that, unlike other property valuation, we first have the task of identifying what companies and businesses are centrally assessable. So that challenge brings us to what we have with the Comcast decision. Is the decision came out in October of 2014, and that really butted up against our process of identifying communication companies and other businesses or services that are centrally assessable. We had a very hurried up process of trying to identify, first of all, understanding what the Supreme Court's decision entailed, and then also how to apply that for identifying if we're following the law appropriately. We had the task of identifying these companies by the end of December, so that gave us a few months. We decided to approach the process by going through an administrative rule process of communicating with stakeholders as to what we believed was the appropriate administrative responsibility from our end. The identification is just one part of the problem. The second part of the problem is to begin communicating with these companies of their central assessment responsibilities. This has to do with what information they file to the department and timely so that we can begin our appraisal work. Again, central assessment is unique. It's not like just going down the street and identifying a house and saying, okay, that's it. We have to, you know, get these businesses that are oftentimes large integrated companies that are operating not just inside the parameters of Oregon, but outside of Oregon as well. So we then have to get that information in a timely manner so that we can begin our appraisal duties on behalf of the Oregon counties, generate the values that then are the basis for the tax bills. A lot of these companies are, there's not a consistent theme. Some are publicly traded, some are not. Some are inside of Oregon, some are outside of Oregon. However, when we do our evaluation, what we're tasked with is identifying the appropriate Oregon property and valuing that property. That includes both tangible and intangible components that Mr. Garst was speaking of. To do this, we approach valuation through what we have defined as a unitary valuation methodology. And this takes into account the integrated nature of companies. The example I used before was, you know, what's the value of a mile of power line? Well, in isolation, depending on its age, it might have very little value. The value that it brings is to the integrated nature of the company who provides a service to customers who then, you know, pay a fee for the services they're getting from that power company. And that integrated nature then adds the value to that mile of power line. And so that is both consideration of the tangible and intangible components. And so when we value the unit of the business that's centrally assessable, we look at all of those aspects. Oregon property is defined in law. So how we, if a company is, you know, say operating outside of the state or has very little exposure to Oregon, we look to the statutes and administrative rules to identify how to allocate property back to Oregon appropriately. Any questions so far in central assessment? I feel like I've been talking about this issue for a long time, so I'm not sure what's known and not known.
Members are not very bashful about this.
Okay,
so
okay.
You should expect to hear from them if they wonder.
Then I'll keep going. In December, we started doing some research, knowing that this was going to be an issue from the legislature, to find out what the other states are doing. We were able to reach out to 42 states, and we found out that 27 of them exempt some form of intangible. There is not a consistent methodology for how the tangible intangible property is exempted from taxation. In some states, just for instance, they will exempt certain components of intangible property, so they won't just give an overall exemption to intangible. They will exempt, for instance, the FCC licenses or the goodwill or something that's identifiable on a financial a document, a 10-K, that sort of thing. Other states will exempt based on some sort of ratio of the tangible and intangible components, so they'll say something like, 10% is identified of the overall value is identified as maybe exemptable intangible property unless can be proved otherwise. The only consistent thing that we found with states is for those states that didn't specifically identify the type and methodology of exemption to apply to intangible, those states were engaged in litigation. So the more clarity that was provided to the assessing authorities, the better there was at not only the administration, but also the predictability from the companies as to what their responsibilities for reporting and the understanding of what would be exempted from taxation. As we get into the discussion of 611, I think we'll be talking about, well, I know we'll be talking about this idea of historical cost or original cost of the tangible property. This is a common term. It's reported. It's currently required in Oregon law for companies who are centrally assessable to report that information. We receive it on companies. We use it in many instances to help us identify the Oregon property. So we go through a ratio process without getting into too much detail. Just suffice to say that it is a pretty consistent, understandable term, and it is currently reported by companies for central assessment purposes.
Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going back again, when you're looking at these other states, the foundational rationale for whatever number they came up with was what? Was it them looking back at us? Was it, what was the foundation for their determination of what it was they're going to tax?
Representative Mintz, members of the committee, are you speaking to what the other states were identifying with the intangible component?
Correct.
Okay. From the companies or the states that we were talking to and the companies that are operating in those states, what we've identified is
There is a limitation on the amount of intangible property that is appropriate for valuation in those states. That would be the consistent theme. How that was achieved varied greatly. In some states, there was a line item exemption for a particular intangible component. Other ways for administration would create sort of a limitation on the amount of intangible. Some states just said it's entirely exempted, the intangible. And that is a huge challenge because even in Oregon, we don't break out value separately between the intangible and tangible property. So does that get to the answer your question?
Yes, please, yeah.
So, well, it sounds as if all states struggled with the issue. Is that a correct statement? Did any of them share with you, this is why we did exactly what we did? Did they have some explanation of how they eventually determined how much of an intangible value to tax?
Representative Benz, members of the committee, we were mostly speaking with the administration side, so other departments of revenues and local jurisdictions that assess companies like we do. We didn't get too much into the politics of what they were specifically exempting. The conversations we did have, it seemed like the issues were similar to the ones that we are facing. The challenge that we have is, okay, how do we get there? How do we get to that reasonable intangible exemption, if you will, and how do you administer it? So from our side, we were focusing more on the administration, the feasibility of the administration, and the challenges that the state's experiences with administering those components were. We weren't too involved in how they got there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, did you finish right then?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, great. Are there other questions that on this topic? Yes, Representative Baker Peterson.
So, for the questions about the other states, there's a consistent and accepted definition of intangible goods when you're having conversations about those. Is that correct?
Representative Vega Pearson, that is correct.
Okay. And then you said 27 states exempt some form of intangibles. Were there more states that just didn't include intangibles at all, or was that included in the 27?
Representative Vega Pearson, members of the committee, I don't have the listing in front of me, but what I recall is that it depends on certain factors. And I know that some states will identify, let me see if I can state this more clearly. Some states limited to very specific property types that could be centrally assessable that included both an intangible and tangible component. For instance, one state didn't centrally assess telephone companies. And so they would only value at the local level the tangible properties they had. That would be for one example. And so we didn't include that into the exemption. It was just how they went about assessing property. But for the 27 states that we did identify, they had a specific exemption to mirror the types of valuation analysis that we do and the responsibilities that we do have in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay, so once again, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, so I'm going to try to build on the background you just received on the central assessment. And I have a document in OLIS. It's titled SB 611A Background, and I'll be working through that. So if you want to follow along. But yeah, so the general idea, as was just discussed by Department of Revenue, is the difference between, or what kind of came to a head, and this was, we saw this beginning in the 2009-10 tax year, was this kind of change in interpretation of the definition of communication. And that what that did is it brought some companies that were, at the time, being locally assessed, came under kind of the umbrella, if you will, of central assessment. And the primary difference there is at the central assessment level, you're being taxed on the tangible value of property as well as the intangible value. And at a local assessment, or when you're locally assessed, it's just on the tangible portion. So when you become centrally assessed, in many cases, you're going to see that valuation increase, and subsequently the tax bill will increase as well. And this is with some of the changes, and this was alluded to by Department of Revenue, some of the changes in the communication industry, we can see a wide variation in the amount of intangible value that makes up a company in the communication industry that could be subject to central assessment. So there could be some wide variation in how much intangible value is being pulled in into the central assessment and the value ultimate valuation process. So the Bill 611, it really deals in, we've tried to split it up into three tiers, three distinct ways to think about it. The first one, so the first that we're calling Tier 1, and all the changes in the bill, I should say this up front, are about providing some level of, it'll result in some level of tax relief for certain types of companies, and the extent of the tax relief will depend upon their exact structure. But this isn't, there's not, there's nothing in the bill that's going to cause an increase or anything along those lines. There's passages in the bill where if for some reason a company doesn't receive benefit under one of these new calculations I'm going to talk about, they would still be assessed the same as they are today. So it can't result in an increase in tax, only potential benefit. So to start off with the Tier 1, one of the first changes is this historic cost. There's a valuation or there's an exemption amount that's going to be based upon the historic cost times 130%. So the department hit on the historic cost a bit, but the idea is that's a tangible number that we have. Historic cost is the value of maybe a piece of property the business purchased. It doesn't include any value for appreciation or depreciation. It's just the value that is there and on the books. That's in the bill as well. It is the booked value of this historic cost, and it's multiplied by 130%, and that gives an exemption amount. And the idea there is that you would take a tangible value that is reported to the Department of Revenue currently, multiply by 130%, and that gives some level of relief related to the intangible value of the property of that business or of that company if they do have that, if they receive benefit from it. There's no guarantee all companies will. In fact, most companies that are under central assessment are not benefiting from any of these exemptions. They're available to them, but their structure doesn't yield any benefit to them. But so that's the first section in Tier 1. There's also two new exemptions in addition to the historic cost cap of 130%. There's one for the value of franchises. So you can think of these are like a communication company, when they're installing fiber or something along those lines, they pay a fee to the cities to run that fiber on, they attach it to the sewers or other rights of way that the cities or the public may own. So there's a value to that, and that is booked at the company level. You can find these on their 10K reports that are filed with SEC and other areas as well. But it would exempt that value. And the distinction here is this exemption would apply to the assessed value at the Oregon assessed value of that company. So in some cases, exemptions are taken off of real market value. In other cases, they can be taken off of assessed value. This one will be taken off of assessed value. And that differs in the second exemption, new exemption that's added, and that is related to the value of satellites. And satellites, that'll be taken off the real market value, and it's an exemption for companies providing communication services directly to retail customers. So the value of their satellite would be exempt, and they can also receive an exemption for their FCC licenses. And just to back up one step, there is, on the books right now, there is an exemption for the value of FCC licenses. That was added, I believe it was enacted in 2001. So that's an exemption that exists right now from intangible value. And one of the specific things for satellites is that they can receive an exemption for companies that own satellites, so they can receive an exemption for their satellites and the value of their FCC licenses if they're used in conjunction with the satellite. And I say that because it differs in many of the other areas where these exemptions cannot be used in multiples of each other. So a company could only receive one of these exemptions. If they receive benefit from this historic cost cap times 130%, they can't then use one or two exemptions on that as well. So the idea was to avoid kind of a double dipping, if you will. And the only exception to that would be the satellites used in conjunction with the FCC licenses. I should add it. There's one other exception to that, and that is there's a provision that allows companies that are receiving exemption under the Enterprise Zone or the Strategic Investment Program, they can still receive those exemptions in addition to these. But in that case, they would usually, the Enterprise Zone will supersede. It'll take off more value than these other exemptions. What we're considering, what we've been calling Tier 2, is really an exemption for a large new investment in communication property. So the bill has a few provisions. This really is going to be large because the way that the exemption is set up, the value that a company would be taxed on would be $250 million or, it's the greater $250 million or the total real market value of the tangible, real, and personal property the company has in Oregon. And this is modeled a little bit on the strategic investment program that really kind of sets an amount that the tax will be applied to, and then anything above that would be exempt. And as this is set up, it would be your tangible property would be taxed, and then anything above that, which would be related to intangibles, could be exempt. Now, the requirements of the bill are set forth of what this large investment would be. Just to hit on a few things, it's talking about symmetrical speed of a communication of 1 gigabit. There's qualification is given to the Public Utility Commission, so they would kind of follow through on these qualifications. There's an application process. I should have mentioned that up front. But listen, the bill, it really is, there's limits on speed or expectation of speed, a minimum speed to qualify for this. There's some limit on prices that's included in the bill, and then also the percent of the market that is covered by any new large investment in communication property. So there are some qualification criteria in the bill. And there's also a reporting requirement, an annual reporting requirement to the legislature as well. And that would come through PUC, but it'd also be with some word from the Department of Revenue about the tax that's not being imposed and so on. And then the Tier 3 portion is really relating to the taxation of data centers here in Oregon. And the idea behind this is really that if a company has a data center, and the way that the exemption is set up, if a company has a data center and that's really their only communication property, primarily their only communication property here in Oregon, there's a limit where they can have up to 10% of the value of the data centers of communication property here in Oregon without being subject to central assessment. But the idea is that if really your footprint is a data center and that's your only communication property, then you would not be subject to central assessment. And once again, that avoids all of your intangible value kind of being pulled in there. There are a few sideboards on there, like I was saying, the 10% cap, and there's clarification in the bill that lists out some of the things that are not to be included. And it really, the important thing to remember is it's only for the 10% cap. What's important is it's the value of your communication property. So if a company has a data center and they also have a number of retail outlets, property unrelated to communication, that's not included in that 10% cap. They can have that. It won't run them into any issues. It won't pull them into central assessment. It's only communication property that could cause that issue. And so the last section I have on the two-pager that's on OLIS is really related to the revenue impact. So this is for the A and Gross version. This is what was included in the bill as it passed. And the first year that it becomes effective would be the fiscal year 16-17. So that's why those numbers are about half in the 15-17 biennium of what's in 17-19 and 19-21. So the revenue impact is about $16.2 million per year. It grows a little bit over time, but that's laid out there. And then also a table we went through on the Senate side a number of times, I think it shows kind of where we are and where we would be under the proposed legislation if it was applied to fiscal year 2014-15. So the bill doesn't actually apply to that year, but we have those figures. So what if we said it was in law for this past property tax year, what would be the impact? So looking at the table, the first column is related to centrally assessed, imposed, excluding deferred billing credits. And not to go into too much detail on the deferred billing credits, but the idea, this kind of represents an outstanding amount related to this new interpretation of communication property. So this amount is that kind of change from local assessment to central assessment. The way this has been set up is the county assessors can kind of set this aside. It's not being collected right now. We'll wait for the conclusion of the court case to decide whether these dollars will come in or not. And the idea is this way no one has to pay penalties or interest when the court case is concluded. But under current law, the total current imposed would be the summing of those two numbers. So working off of the 2014-15, the total current law imposed would be about $278.8 million, and this is related to centrally assessed property. The imposed amount with the changes in Senate Bill 611, would result in a total imposed of $263 million. So that difference between the 278.8 figure and 263.0 figure is the revenue loss in SB 611 if it was applied back to 2014-15. And it gives some indication of where we are under prior to the expansion, if you will, in the interpretation of communication, and where we'd be after the changes of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Can I just clarify, those deferred billing credits, are those just Comcast, since they are who is involved, who has been involved in this lawsuit? Is that who that is for?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, primarily, yes. They can. It's a program that's available to the assessors. Any property over, I believe it's $1 million in assessed value, they can choose to use the deferred billing credit as a mechanism. But certainly that case is kind of the largest one, so the amount outstanding there really does dwarf a lot of the other usages. And we've checked with a few counties, and some are more likely to use them than others. So in some counties, it could be the Comcast decision could represent all, and in others, there could be four or five properties. But, I mean, it's fair to say you're talking 97, 98% is represented there, yeah.
And does that, may I follow up, sir?
Yes, please.
And as you go down, are those cumulative, or would you need to add them all together to find out how much, or is it really, you know, can you really do that kind of math on it?
Yeah. Yes, Chair Barnhart.
Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes. These are annual figures. The 14-15 figure is it's an estimate. It's kind of trending the growth upwards. We're still waiting for reporting on that. But these are annual amounts. So if the case was concluded tomorrow and it was ruled entirely in favor of Department of Revenue, how they've been administering it, that would be current law, the way it's displayed here. It would be the sum total of that.
So the 11.9 plus 13.3 plus 16.4?
Yes.
So every one of those years, every one of those deferred billing credits added together, that is the amount, if the resolution was found in favor of the Department of Revenue, that would be the amount that was outstanding from Comcast and anyone else who has been using these deferred billing credits.
Yes, that is correct. There could be some other maybe small amounts, like you were saying, that are unrelated to the Comcast decision. But, yeah, that's the general idea, as you'd be talking. All that would be coming in.
And that's the $87 million about?
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner, I believe it. If you put it around.
That looks.
Trying to sum it real quick. But I think it was in more like the $115 million range for all of it.
Okay.
And
I'm trying to figure out, and I'm not sure this is from you guys or someone else, this chart.
No, that is not our.
Because it references LRO figures, but I wasn't sure if it was from you or not. So.
Yes, reference.
Okay, thank you.
Paul?
Representative, that's from Senator Hass, and he'll be here in just a minute.
Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Leininger, please.
I am still trying to learn about what's happening in this agreement, and it's new to me. But I have a question about, in the proposed bill, how did it get decided that franchise fee agreements would be exempted?
I think that's a great question for the negotiators.
Okay.
Unless you want to try to answer it.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leininger, I think part of the discussion that was had is, in some cases, franchises can be viewed for one company similar to FCC licenses, with some of the arguments that were made. So some companies, the FCC license represents the spectrum that they need in order to operate. And for other companies that are putting wire in the ground, they need those franchise agreements to be able to provide their service. And I think that was kind of the argument that was made, if you are that was proposed or talked about, yeah.
Okay.
Were you finished? I'm not sure.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You are. Okay. Any other questions for this panel? We have our expert from the department for another few minutes, if you have any questions for him. Otherwise, we're going to let this panel go, and I think we have some members to hear from next. Yes. And then we'll take the witnesses off of our list, and we have quite a list today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the testimony. Don't be surprised if some or all of us are back to ask more questions. Ah, and here they are. Please. Senator Hass, Representative McLean. Thank you so much for being here today, and thank you for the work on this bill in the Senate. As we are beginning to study it, we realize what an enormous complexity it is and the huge amount of work that you had to do in order to get this far. And whatever you want to tell us about, we'd love to hear it, assuming it's on the bill.
Oh, okay. Well, no. Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Hass, State Senate, representing the Beaverton, Washington County area. We've been working on this for 4 months, and some of you have immersed yourselves in subjects from, you know, the environment to marijuana, and you know what that's like when you're up on all of these things. Well, this little tiny slice of the universe was what we've been working on for a long time now, and it took me time to hear the phrase historical cost less depreciation to finally get my head around what it is, or intangibles proxy, those sorts of phrases that are embedded in this bill. What really allowed me to get my head around this to begin with was to think about how they started this 100 years ago, and that was on to tax property taxes on railroads, which is how we got this. And if you think about 10 miles of railroad track going through Marion County, the Marion County tax assessor would say, I don't know what that's worth. Really, it's worth nothing, 10 miles of railroad track. And so this happened in jurisdictions all over the country, and they said, this is something the central government should figure out. What is that railroad worth to its owner, Burlington Northern or Southern Pacific? And so the central government, central assessment, would figure out what that company is worth, and the counties would set a price, and that's how they would pay their property tax. And over the years, of course, it got extended to utilities, to airlines, and into a trickier category of communications. And that's where we are today. And so that's what central assessment really is. And it took me years to even put my head around that part of it. And then to figure out how to make changes really got dicey in the wake of this Supreme Court decision. So that's what we've been buried in for the last 4 months. It did pass the Oregon Senate 27-3. In the last 5 years, central assessment has been a thorny, difficult, controversial, contentious, painful, litigated problem. Most of you know intangibles are things like intellectual property, brand value, copyrights, FCC licenses, goodwill, and that's what the Supreme Court in October said the state could tax in its computation of central assessment. Didn't have to, but it could. But here's the problem. The Oregon statutes never envision companies with such gargantuan intangibles like Apple, Facebook, Google, and Amazon. And we want Oregon to continue to be attracted to those companies. In my opinion, those are the Fords and Chryslers of this century, and it's in Oregon's best interest to be participating in the technical transformation that they're leading. But that won't happen if we don't pass this bill. Because right now there is, I envision this red blinking light on our state that is telling out-of-state communications companies and the technology industry, watch out, there's a problem up here. In fact, it's sending that signal to a lot of states who are already here. Some of them aren't even communication companies, but they're wondering if down the road, because of this ruling, it might include those. So, after months of meeting with a work group, and I want to thank Representatives Barnhart, Vega Peterson, and my friend here, Representative McLean, we came up with an approach that doesn't get rid of intangibles as industry wanted. That would have been too much of a blow, we thought, to local governments. But instead, it caps tangibles at 130% of their value. From there, we exempted franchise agreements, I know you've heard some of this, to make it consistent with current exemptions on FCC licenses. So that gave communication companies much needed certainty, but it did not give them a tax break. NBC Comcast, for example, will pay considerably more. In fact, their property tax rates in Oregon will be the highest in the country under this bill. We also added an incentive for high-speed internet, gigabit. Gigabit speeds are 1,000 megabits per second, 25 times faster than the new federal definition of broadband service. And I think it's this provision that switches off that red blinking light to a green light. And finally, the data centers, you'll hear more from that, from this on Representative McLean, but those are those giant server farms that we need to keep expanding. But they won't expand without this bill that clearly says they are not a communications company and therefore not subject to central assessment. One of the reasons this bill is moving so quickly, we had to suspend rules in the Senate to get it out when we did, but one of the reasons is because there are some enormous economic development opportunities that are pending right now. I should say that nobody got 100% of what they wanted in this bill. Nobody ever does in a tax bill. And on that note, I do want to address the legislative revenue impact report that you had that shows a $16 million of a revenue impact. And I wanted to try to talk to you about that because that is a number that, as our work group found out, isn't really real. It's the same kind of dynamic as when the quarterly forecasts come out and assumes that the tax credits that are out there that are scheduled to sunset will actually sunset, when in fact most of us know that most of them, many of them, maybe all of them, will not sunset. But the forecasters have to go by current law. There is a chart that you have that shows a better figure to look at is where we were when the litigation on intangibles started in 2009 versus where we would be today if this bill passed, and that's an $87 million annual increase to counties and all of their special districts. So I really hope that you on this committee can do the sort of intellectual heavy lifting to see that yourself and do not be rolled by opponents who are hanging their hat on that legislative impact number. So with that, I will turn it over to my good colleague from Prineville.
Thank you, members. Representative Barnhart, our chair, and members of the committee, I'm Mike McLean. I represent House District 55 in the legislature. My thanks go out to Senator Hass for his work bringing very diverse parties together to the table to try to find a way through this very complex and minefield of central assessment. I appreciate the work of our chair, Representative Barnhart, and Representative Vega Peterson in working to get this done. Henry Kissinger has got nothing on Mark Hass. This has been an incredible diplomacy that we have witnessed by the good senator from Beaverton bringing all these folks to the table. This coalition is fragile. I urge you to move Senate Bill 611 quickly for a couple of reasons. One, anything more than just simple technical amendments at this point could blow up the coalition. There are lots of interests at play, and right now demands to make this bill perfect have become the enemy of the good. We need to move the bill. Second of all, there are interests in selfishly in my district being most poignant, where if we don't have resolution quickly, economic opportunity will leave the state of Oregon. That will not be replaced. In the testimony before the Senate, City Councilor Jason Carr brought forth some information. He's the City Council for Prineville. Crook County has the highest unemployment in the state. Based upon a recent survey of the 20 poor cities in Oregon, I believe Prineville was second to last. We have endured 30 years of depressed economy as our force have shut down regulations, mounting upon regulations on all sorts of natural resource-based industry. And then in the middle of the recession, Les Schwab died, and the corporate headquarters was moved from Prineville thankfully only to Bend. The choice was Bend or to California, so it's just up the road. But blow after blow after blow. One of the good news stories in the midst of the Great Recession was Facebook, who chose Prineville to locate a very significant data center. Here are the facts. Right now, Facebook employs approximately 75 people, and I believe when you add up all of the folks that are Facebook employed in Prineville, it's over 100. I don't have the right number. Average salary is $50,000. That's a very significant amount. The amount of grants that they have given to our school district and nonprofits is about $1.8 million. The additional franchise fees related to electrical usage has put in Prineville coffers about $1.5 million per year. This has been a tremendous asset. They have been great citizens. Apple wants to locate in Prineville and build an even bigger complex. But when you sit back and say, what do we look at with 200 to 300 jobs that average $50,000 in the second poorest city in the most unemployed county, that's a lifeline. So I know that there may be criticism of this bill, but I would hope that you would hear that we need to move the bill fast, and we need to be clear for industry that Oregon is not only, let me put it this way, that Oregon welcomes technology companies. We're not going to switch, bait and switch. We are going to fulfill our obligations that we've made before. And then finally, Oregon has a legislature and a governor that are going to make the necessary adjustments to maintain a tax policy that is consistent with advancing technology and industry. We're not trying, no one here, especially myself, who represents District 55, the second largest district in the state, full of communities that are struggling. Nobody's trying to limit local government and resources that are due them. That's not the goal. But if people don't come, we get something of nothing. But if people do come, technology companies do arrive here, we're going to have an overall economic benefit and increased revenue. I want to point out one thing. Facebook uses less water than the laundromat next door. The technology of data centers has advanced, and the efficiencies of the high desert of Central Oregon in cooling servers and in making these data centers run on the minimal amount of energy is extraordinary. Facebook gave away its technology, opened it up to others, and said, use this. I believe their energy is 40% less than what was initially projected. So these data centers are positive. They breed more industry, and that is a positive in an area where people are looking for a reason to come back to rural Oregon. And with that, I thank you. I can answer questions about the bill, but I will say this. In the midst of Senator Hass's amazing diplomacy, Representative Barnhart's analytical mind, there have been two people, I think Representative Vega Peterson and myself, that have been the people that have been, this is great, just move the bill, move the bill. And I know she has interest in seeing technology companies come to Portland. I have interest in seeing technology companies come to Prineville. It has been balanced, I believe, in how we approached it. So thank you all.
Thank you very much. Questions for these two? Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions for both you. Representative McLean first. So how long has that Facebook server farm been in Prineville?
Representative Barnhart and Representative Smith-Warner, I believe it's been there 4 years.
Okay. And is that the only one in the state?
For Facebook, it
yes.
is.
Okay. And there are there other server farms elsewhere in the state besides that one in Prineville, the Facebook one?
Representative Smith Warner, there are other server farms or data centers like Google and elsewhere in the DALs. And I believe there are 58 in the state. I'm not sure of the exact locations. I know many in Hillsboro.
Thank you.
And if I may, Representative Smith Warner, there are some on the drawing board. Mm-hmm. I think Amazon has two are under construction, and you'll hear from them. They'd like to build 14, but everything's on hold.
Okay.
Depending the resolution of this situation.
Okay. Can I ask one more about that, and then another one to Senator Haas specifically?
Sure. Yes,
thank
please.
You.
Yeah.
So, and are those 58 data centers, are they currently centrally assessed?
Representative Barnhart and Representative Smith Warner,
I know you're not Department of Revenue or anything, but
I am not aware of whether they all are. I know that many of them are in enterprise zones, and because of a bill the legislature passed in 2012, the ability to centralize or centrally assess data centers in enterprise zones was nullified. So there could be, I believe Bend Broadband has a data center not in an enterprise zone, if I recall. But I think there may be some centrally assessed.
So you believe that some are centrally assessed and some are not?
I speculate that many are not, because I believe the enterprise zones have been attractive to their location. But I'd have to defer.
Can we hear from the department on that question? Yeah, just quickly.
So, Mark Garst, Oregon Department of Revenue, Representative Smith Warner. There may be one or two that are picked up in a unit that's a larger company, but generally speaking, Representative McLean said it right. Most of them are in enterprise zones, and under the current statute, they are accepted from central assessment, so they're not currently being centrally assessed.
Okay.
Maybe some smaller ones, but the vast majority are not, and particularly these kind of large, what you really think of when you think of a data center.
And are those because they're in those enterprise zones, are the terms of it that as long as the enterprise zone timeline is on, they will not be centrally assessed?
Yes.
Finite then.
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. That is the way that the statute sits now. This bill would change that so that enterprise zone was not a requirement. I think that there are a couple that are coming close. So they're 2 to 3 years from falling out of the enterprise zone. Others are in these extended rural enterprise zones that can go 10 to 15 years. So there's a wide variety there of when they would be pulled out.
Thank you.
There are a number of businesses, aren't there, that are talking about setting up data centers in Oregon that really don't have much other presence here.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they do, it's a presence which is irrelevant because they're retail shops or something like that. I've always been of the view, personally, that a data center is not a communications activity. If it is, then this is a communications activity, even though I don't own the connection from here to the internet. Every law office is a communications company. If a data center is in the communications business as such, so I've been bemused a bit about all the discussion we've had about that, perfectly willing to look at the specific language that helped these big companies feel better about it. But I don't think they're taxable as communication companies anyway. If they are, then a whole lot of businesses are taxable as communications companies that aren't now taxed that way, in my opinion. Now, I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but that's been my view for a couple of years.
Well, a lot of those companies were uncertain, and these investments
are $1 billion. I understand that.
Yeah.
I'm willing to make them feel better. I'm willing to make certain that they understand that we're not going to tax them as centrally assessed companies. But I think that we're not giving away much when they're not communications businesses in the first place. I'm thinking about the local perspective here rather than the business perspective. Yes.
And if I may, I think that one of the things that gave them a lot of uncertainty was the fact that the statute as it's currently written says as long as you're in an enterprise zone, then you're not centrally assessed. And it kind of logically follows that if you then come out of the enterprise zone, you would be centrally assessed. So I don't think that was an intended consequence of the so-called Facebook legislation, but I think that it's been a direct result.
Well, and of course, we know, sitting where we do, that drafting is about two-thirds of where you make your big mistakes without intending to. I'm sorry, I interrupted the flow.
No, I was going to say, I had one question.
Please,
for Senator Hass. So your this that you distributed, the your assessment of the $87 million revenue increase as opposed to a revenue hit, does that just reflect the Comcast payment?
No, Comcast payments are in green. And there was a separate conversation about how that tax court issue plays out, but it's irrelevant to this case. My opinion is it will be very beneficial to the cities and counties, but that's a different story for a different day. This just keeps it in perspective, is that these tax totals to counties and their school districts continue to go up. This bill puts it up even higher. And if we were to do nothing, you would see that 16.2, and I hope nobody is entertaining the idea of doing nothing here.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Leininger.
Thank you.
Leininger. Boy, I'm sorry. I am a bit under the weather today, and I'm sure it's obvious. I'll get it right eventually. Representative Leininger, please.
So thank you both for your work on this, and thank you to everyone who's been involved with this. It sounds like a complicated project, and I think you have made a great effort on it. As you both know, I used to be a Clackamas County Commissioner. So the needs of local government entities are something I have keenly in my mind, and now I represent part of Multnomah County and part of Clackamas County, and I have heard from advocates for local jurisdictions about the $16.2 million in annual revenue that would be foregone through this agreement. And, you know, I think about in Clackamas County, we spent more than half of our general fund revenue on public safety, you know, community corrections, reentry programs, drug and alcohol treatment for people trying to reenter the system. We spent it on, you know, domestic violence response services. We spent it on school-based health center grants. We spent it on really important things. And so I know you've done a ton of work on this, and you would like to have us endorse the good work, but I feel like we really have to probe it and look at it closely in order to do the due diligence we owe to our constituents. So with full respect and appreciation for the work you've done, I have a couple questions. One of them has to do with some information that I've heard, and maybe you can tell me if this is not your understanding, but it sounds like a significant portion of the $16.2 million a year, from what I understand, would be the result of an increased exemption for existing businesses, possibly $8.5 million, that has to do with the local franchise fee agreements. Is that the case, and why are we giving increased, from what I understand, it came toward the very end of the negotiation process to existing businesses, maybe unrelated to adding jobs? Is that what's happening?
I'll take it. Okay, go ahead. No, it's not. That's an incorrect interpretation. That change was made in lieu of depreciation. Historical cost less depreciation is sort of a standard accounting practice that some states and jurisdictions apply in these kinds of companies. Doing the franchise fee exemption was more expensive for the companies and greater revenue for the counties if we did it that way, and less administrative work for the department. And so that's why there was a policy decision to do that. So the figure would have been higher had we stayed with historical costs, less depreciation. And it also is consistent with other exemptions in the law, specifically that with wireless transmissions. FCC licenses, which aren't intangible, are also exempt previous to this.
Okay. May I ask one follow-up?
Yes, please.
And then another thing that I have been advised is a point of concern for some of my constituents is that at one time I understand that a settlement of litigation with Comcast was considered an element of a negotiated package. And my question is, where do things stand on settlement discussions? Is that not part of the proposed resolution, and how did that come to be disjoined?
Well, I'll answer the first. It was never a part of this bill. It couldn't be. And anybody who talks about it is doing just that, speculating. You're an attorney. You know how those things go. You can talk to anybody and get different answers. And that will play itself out in natural course, but it is not involved at all, nor would it be appropriate to be involved in this policy discussion.
Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
I like Mark Hass. He's
yes. Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So thank you both for coming here today to testify to talk about this issue. As we're introducing it on the House side, there's been a lot of work that was done over on the Senate side and through the work group process. And I think, Representative McLean, you said it correctly. We've been wanting this to happen. And from my perspective of being on the work group, there was some initial discussions on this just being a data center fix, just looking at the Tier 3 component in this bill. And one of the things that I've been pushing for this whole time is let's take the opportunity to have a full discussion on this issue of intangibles and central assessment, of some of the economic development opportunities that are happening all across the state, and really work on it to try to solve that issue today. And so I just want to commend you for all the work that you've done on this, and also to the Legislative Revenue Office staff, who's been incredible in doing the work on this. Kyle, this was your hazing, I think, of coming on board with LRO, but it's been great to really understand the complexities of this and how so many people that are done on this. I think that one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity to do on the House, I am interested in seeing this bill go forward and so that we can address this issue, but making sure that we on the House Revenue Committee have a chance to understand the issue, understand the impacts, and have a really good discussion about it. And so that's why I'm glad we're having the opportunity to do that now.
Great. Yes, Representative Vance.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all your hard work on this. You mentioned, I think both of you alluded to some need to move quickly. Perhaps you can elaborate how quickly and why.
Yes, Representative Barnhart and Vance, there are several companies that, because of the nature of their business and the speed in which they make decisions, Oregon will be excluded from the short list, and I think actually the list, the location, based upon our continued uncertainty with the status quo of the law today. Second of all, there is the political consequence that, whether unintended or not, that we give industry by having such a clear problem with locating a technology company here. For an example, I don't know if these numbers are completely accurate, but I've heard it said that if a technology company, say Google, located a fiber network here at a cost of $300 million, under the current law, their tax assessment would be $91 million a year. Because that's a nullifier of investment. Our tax laws are, in essence, nullifying the private sector investment. And of course, nobody really wants to see that happen. So by having the consequence of that here and then to have us not make this decision further exacerbates the efforts of our executive branch in our counties in trying to assure technology companies that Oregon can solve problems. Now, the one company that is looking at Prineville is Apple, and they have been public about their need for a certainty. They consider the status quo to be uncertain, meaning that if you have a data center located in the enterprise zone, the lack of clarity as to what happens when the enterprise zone agreement terminates has become preclusive of their choice of Prineville unless we act. And so I don't know when their timeline is, but I know we passed March 1st, which I believe was pretty critical. However, because the Senate had moved quickly and because of Senator Hass's work and Vince Porter from the executive branch, Prineville still has a shot. And so my hope is that the House will move this bill quickly. And I'd say Representative Benz, and also to speak to Representative Angie Peterson's comments too, you know, the while there are three components, this issue of central assessment is a cloud. And while the opportunity for Excel spreadsheets to think how much we would get, how much a county would get, how much a city would get, are a lot like entrepreneurs speculating how rich they'll become when they start their company. I've been at a few of those coffee meetings, and you know, you can't go out and buy the second home based upon that spreadsheet. In other words, there's a lot to happen between that and then. What we're talking about on a lot of the impacts here are based upon assumptions. And of course, if Oregon sends a wrong signal, those assumptions could evaporate, and then we're actually reducing the amount of revenue for our cities and counties.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. I echo the comments of the folks who've spoken before me as to your work. My apologies, I had to leave a bit earlier, so perhaps you already covered this, but I was looking at your written testimony, and I wanted to make sure I understood the dynamics on your chart and the way that the bill works and the revenue impact. So I think I'm understanding this to suggest that with the bill, we're still going to see an $87 million increase, and that the revenue impact is just a difference between what would be in current law as opposed to the bill, but that there's still a net increase of $87 million. Have I got that right? Perhaps you could amplify on that what I've missed.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed, yes, that's correct. The 16.2 is, in my opinion, an illusory number based upon us doing nothing, similar to the revenue forecasts when the current law says all of those sunsets will happen to the tax credits. And, you know, everyone knows we're not going to leave this building without the working family credit. And so that's what that $16 million figure represents to me.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, Clackamas County will be a lot better with the kind of activity this will generate, particularly with a high-speed fiber line around the metro area, than if we did nothing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Others? Yes.
Sorry.
I
apologize, Senator. I just am still having a hard time getting to where does that $87 million come from?
It's just, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, it's not coming from any magical spring. It's there. It's
okay.
Actually happening, and I right. believe in what's real is real, not what is a projection based upon something that won't happen. This is real. This is actually happening. These rates are not going down. Nobody's going to pay. Nobody's getting a gigantic tax break. To be frank, what industry wanted was to remove intangibles from this process, and we didn't do that. What the local governments wanted was to maximize the tax rates on everybody as high as possible, and we didn't do that either. I think we reached a very fair middle ground in a collaborative spirit in a way that shows that we can work together in this building and still find a common ground that benefits Oregon.
And I would like to add, Representative Smith Warren, I think the we're one of the few states that centrally assesses intangibles. I don't believe that is all 50 states, if I recall, and maybe Representative.
Yeah, we heard testimony on that earlier.
Okay, so how many states is it, Mr. Chair?
Two.
No. About half.
About half.
Okay. Well, 27 exempt some part of intangibles.
Right.
I guess my point is that this isn't – it's certainly not unforeseen that Oregon will join other states in actually eventually phasing out intangibles because of the speed in which technology companies are advancing and how this is all sort of moving together in communications. I would say this. It's not just industry saying that I think in central assessment of intangibles is unworkable. I mean, I look forward 10, 20 years, and you can see how eventually I'm not sure how we continue in this assessment of intangibles given where technology's heading and the complete block it puts on incentives to come to Oregon when there's such a disparity. So the balance struck by Senate Bill 611 is a balance because, it's not absurd for people to say, look, get out of the intangible game because other states have and I predict more will year by year.
But I just feel obliged to say I think you cannot say that the fact that we have 58 server farms in this state already speaks to the fact that this state has a lot of areas that are amenable to, that they have very specific needs that they have geographically, climatically, and the fact that we already have 58 here, despite the, purported uncertainty of our tax structure, I think speaks to the intangible value of locating here for this particular kind of technology, and I think that's just important to acknowledge.
If I may,
I'd just say, Representative, I think that is more pronounced of the success of enterprise zones. I think they're here because of enterprise zones. I think, but for the enterprise zones, I'm not sure how many would have.
And Representative, this is a relatively recent phenomenon in Oregon's tax history. The intangibles, the skyrocketing value, and the policy decisions, and Paul has more on when this all started and the lawsuit.
Yes, Senator, the growth of intangibles has been strong, but the states have looked at that, been looking at this for well over 10 years. So it is an issue that's come up in a lot of states. So, I think the real issue, as was presented earlier, was about the communications property and how that's defined as Department of Revenue went through, and that goes back to 06. And that's when that issue has begun to emerge and potentially affect the data centers.
Okay. Representative Pence?
Mr. Chair, there's been, in the years I've been on this committee, many, 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 many discussions about this. And I don't know how many times I've drawn the little columns for incumbent, wireless, cable, and the little different heights of tax within each. I've lost track. I have notebooks filled with them. Am I hearing that if we pass this, we are done with those conversations? I can throw those notebooks away because no longer can we attack this issue, because to do so would upset some structure that we've constructed and people have now relied upon it. I guess I'm asking, is the conversation over when we pass this bill? And if not, what remains?
Well, I would say, Representative Vince, the conversation's over for the probably your and I's legislative career, but I think I'm just saying that. my apologies to
Representative Pence plans to be here a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Your longevity, perhaps I'm projecting myself in your shoes, but I think I think it settles it in Oregon for a while. But what I'm saying is, I look out ahead, and what happens is, I think in communications, you can just see that there's. That eventually it becomes more and more difficult to centrally assess. I'm not saying that we'll never revisit it. I just think it does put it to bed for quite a while.
If I may, Representative, I would say don't put your notebooks away. that there's still some fixes down the road. This fixes the problem for now. Deeply embedded in the property tax foundation is the Measure 50 limits that makes life a nightmare for the department and complicates everything. And when these giant companies like Google start assessing, the first thing that somebody has to explain to them is Measure 50 and how to incorporate that into their figures. If we could clean that language up, other things have become remarkably easier. For example, I think you could then make a case for removing intangibles from this process. But I think that's the one that would come first. That would require a statewide vote. So,
thank you.
And I'll note, Senator, that you're getting some head nods from some smart people behind you as you say that.
Yeah.
We'll keep working on it.
Okay.
Other questions for these two? We have a bunch of other witnesses. I'd like to get to at least some of them today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the wise counsel and the hard work. The witnesses I have do not break down into easy three people groups, so I'm just going to call some people up and recognize that their positions may not be identical or even similar. Let's start with Doug Cooley and Greg Chamoff, please.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, appearing on behalf of Yahoo. You are correct. We have different interests, Mr. Cooley and I. I was heartened by the chair's comments about what does and does not constitute communication, because that's the issue that brings Yahoo before this body. Mm-hmm. We have a problem that I hope you can help us solve. Senate Bill 611 is a step in the right direction, but with your help could provide some additional clarity and predictability for the future without, I want to hasten to add, reducing anyone's tax bills. We are not now centrally assessed, and it is not, I understand, the department's intent to centrally assess Yahoo, and we'd like to keep it that way. We got into this situation back in the 2009-10 tax year. Yahoo is an internet information company. It has a website. You can get your news there. You can search for information on the web through its search engine. You can sign up for an account and get an email account, and through that engage in activities. I do that for my fantasy teams. But Yahoo does not have any pipes, wires, fiber, satellites, any means of conveying my electrons to it or its electrons to me. At my home, I have Mr. Cooley's service. It's wonderful. And that's what I use to communicate with Yahoo. And when Yahoo wants to communicate with me, Yahoo has to sign up for the same kind of service that I do, although perhaps on a grander scale. In Oregon, the only property that Yahoo has is an office building in Washington County. There are many nice people who work there selling advertising for the website. There are some not so nice people there who help law enforcement fight cyber crimes. But nothing that happens in that building has to do with the business of communication. Yahoo's office building used to be locally assessed. Beginning in the 2009-10 tax year, Yahoo got a notice from the department saying, congratulations, you are now a communication company and you have millions more dollars in property in Oregon than you thought you did. And we sued, and that lasted for a couple of years. And those lawsuits are still in the tax court. We are still disputing with the Department of Revenue whether Yahoo was in the 2009-10, and I think the next and perhaps even the year after that tax year, whether Yahoo is a communication company. But after a couple of years, the department decided to stop taxing Yahoo as a communication company. And in an effort to put into law why the department thought Yahoo was a communication company, so that you could say it's not, we have language at page 7, line 33 of your bill that describes what data transmission services do not include. And when we asked the Department of Revenue, why did you consider Yahoo to be a communication company, the answer was because you provide people, if they want it, with an email account, and you have a search engine. Now, it's our view that neither of those things, the box in which electrons travel through someone else's pipes, wires, fibers, etc., or a search engine, constitutes communication as you folks defined it in law. But as the bill currently reads, so long as you provide those services, I guess, through someone else's pipes, wires, fibers, etc., it doesn't count as data transmission services. A problem is that that lists only two services that we do. In the Comcast case itself, the Supreme Court identified the myriad other kinds of information and content accessible through the internet that, if provided through someone else's fibers, pipes, wires, etc., is not data transmission services. And our goal is to broaden what's currently in 611 so that we can make clear that it's not just email and search engines carried through other people's transmission infrastructure. It's content, information, and whatever you think in the best public policy is to exclude from data transmission services when you aren't the company that is transmitting one way or the other that content or that email account. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think given that these two have very, very different interests, we'll ask for questions for Mr. Chamoff first. I think you were very clear.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You very much. NBC Comcast.
Thank you, Mr.
Excuse, sir.
Oh, are we likely to have questions for him? I think not. I think you're finished. Go take care of your hand.
Thank you. I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Cooley. I work for Comcast, representing Comcast, NBC, and some of our other affiliates. And I thought I'd share a few comments just in light of context on the Senate Bill 611 that's before you and before this committee. We support Senate Bill 611 as it's written, and as some of the other parties have mentioned, we think it is a good compromise. We did not get everything we wanted out of this, and I think that's fair to say for many of the parties. But as currently assessed, if you don't pass Senate Bill 611, Comcast property taxes in Oregon would go up six times. That, I think, was mentioned about what a red light, what a message that sends to the rest of the to the rest of the country, to other states, and to other tech investment. It would be, by a landslide, the highest per customer property tax in our footprint in the country. So these kind of increased costs lead to increased cable bills. So that drives customers to alternatives like satellite and your wireless plan where you can watch Netflix on your iPad and things like that. But none of those other...
Can you provide us with your property tax bills in the other states and in Oregon so that we can make those comparisons you're talking about? The numbers we have from the chair of the Finance and Revenue Committee are interesting, but they're not broken out. It would be useful if we could get your assessment broken out, both what you thought it was before the court case and what it turns out to be.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll research what is publicly available, what can be shared with the committee so as to help shed light on the
property taxes. Pretty much are public everywhere, aren't they?
Eventually, yes.
Pretty much.
I would
okay.
think so.
Thank you.
That would be
extremely helpful. When you make the claim that it's going to result in increased cable bills, then I think it's useful for the committee to understand the reach of the company and how that might apply to Oregon.
Right. Well, and to the point, I think increased costs, customers pay eventually, you know, that's our revenue stream is from customers. And one of the more frequent complaints I think we have is the cost. And so driving those customers, I guess, to alternatives leads to, ironically, those revenues that are paid by franchise fees and privilege taxes not going to the cities or the local municipalities that you're trying to protect. So, I mean, for example, Comcast paid over $30 million in franchise fees and privilege taxes last year. So, our first thing is a competitive equity argument that's been done in other states and in this state with the wireless folks. But it's also an economic model discussion about how far is too far. The other thing I think that might be worth mentioning is that if Senate Bill 611 is passed, our property taxes will triple from what we were paying locally. And, you know, despite some of the numbers that are out there, we are, again, trying to reach a compromise where we could work with a moderate tripling of our property taxes.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Smith Warner.
So under Senate Bill 611, your property tax would triple from what you have been paying now while you have not been paying them while the litigation was undergoing? Or from what you will end up being assessed after the Supreme Court decision?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith Warner, the tripling number comes from comparing what we would pay under local assessment to what our value and assessment would be under central assessment with the franchise exemption. Does that help? Is that?
A little bit, but not what you would pay under what the Supreme Court has decided that. And I'm not making any value judgments. What you should have been paying over the course of the years while the court case was underway.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe you are talking about two different things. Yeah, the litigation would be a separate comparison.
Okay.
But does that help?
Just a quick comment, if I could, on this topic. The question is what kind of denominator are you using? If you're looking at what the taxes used to be before the central assessment started, then the tripling number sounds sensible. I haven't seen the numbers, but that sounds like the number you're talking about. If you're looking at the value based on central assessment, then, of course, that's still subject to the Measure 50 limits that we haven't got litigated yet, and I have no idea what that does. But at that point, then 611 may very well be a decrease in the taxes that are due, and that's where this orange piece on the last column of Senator Hass's document comes from. So I think it's important as we conceptualize this is that we keep in mind these two different sets of denominators and different ways of approaching the question. I think the statement is accurate, but it depends on one denominator, not the other. Is that a fair way of saying it?
If I follow you, Mr. Chair, yes, I think it is, and it is, you know, somewhat confusing, but we are happy to have that conversation and perhaps, you know, offline with the denominator and the, I guess, hypothetical, number of the Supreme Court decision, because that doesn't have a number assigned to it yet. That's, yes, you'll be centrally assessed, but there's no clear methodology or anything. So,
we're still dealing with the assessed value issue.
Okay.
Is that right, at the tax court?
Correct. I mean, again, I'm not the litigation expert, but I think you're right. The baseline,
right.
The maximum assessed value.
The maximum assessed value issue is still to be litigated at the tax court.
Correct.
That's what I understand.
That's at least one component.
The numbers that the senator gave us are based on the assumption that that's already done, I think. And, in fact, it isn't done.
I believe that's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
As compared to, yeah.
Yes. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Chair. And I had asked earlier, in a vacuum, what is the proper standard to which you think your company should be held? You mentioned if certain things happen, you'd have to pay six times more than X, or if this goes through three times more than X, well, what should it be? And I just want to know, because the other states have some means of reaching some appraised value, and I'm struggling to figure out what that standard should be. If your company is worth $500 billion and it's all intangible, and you do 5% of your business in Oregon, the old way would have been 5% of that $500 billion. That doesn't seem to make much sense. What does make sense?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, that's a good question. I think when you look at the rest of the country, I think there's many states that don't address intangibles for this very reason. Of the states that do, which appears to be about 27, I think was said, I believe all of those do some sort of moderation, mitigation of that kind of hyperinflated intangible number that's so volatile. So I think what we're arguing for, what is reasonable in this situation, is Senate Bill 611, which is an exemption that has been done in other states for a franchise. It's an exemption that's been done in this state for wireless carriers. And it puts the, I guess, reasonable, moderate approach in a financial situation that we can live with and we're used to. We have pushed for all intangibles being removed. We have pushed for high cost, less depreciation, which had a similar economic impact. But those are methodologies that lead you to a similar place than what Senate Bill 611 has right now. And while it's not ideal or perfect, I think was the word that was used earlier, I think it's something we can live with for reasonable in this situation, in this state.
Thank you.
And you hadn't finished, so let's get back to where you were. And
well, thank you. Just a few other comments, and you know, I think it's worth talking about that. Our company is committed to broadband, to technology, to video, to voice, and to, you know, the other products and services that our customers want. For example, we have a low-income broadband program that gets broadband in the hands of those who dearly need it. Families who qualify for free or reduced school lunch can get broadband from us at $9.95. 9,000 Oregon homes currently take advantage of that program. And as far as putting a red light or chilling investment in this state, we don't want to do that. We don't want to have that red light on our particular company either. We have our affiliate, I mean, Grimm, that's filmed in Portland, spends $50 million every single year filming a season. We want to be able to keep that stuff here, or at least have a rational argument for continuing to invest in the state. We spend hundreds of millions. I don't have a breakdown on the number on our network to get those products and services out there, which increase that base. We look for other opportunities to invest. We have a call center here. We're looking for other opportunities around the country, and we don't want Oregon to have that red light on it either. So from an economic development standpoint and from a fairness standpoint and from not being an outlier in the rest of the country or just in this state in the matter of fairness, we feel like Senate Bill 611 is a nice compromise.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair, and not related necessarily, and I hope I'm not speaking out of school or inappropriately, but I think it's fair to say from one of the comments earlier that the pending litigation is separate and apart. Yeah. But I guess I could say this. Certainty for the future in our state and our operations and our investments we're certainly motivated to settle the past. In some way, shape, or form. Obviously, it takes two parties to settle, but I hope I haven't overstepped any bounds, but that's our mindset.
Thank you. The department is sitting behind you and listening carefully. it would be useful, I think, if you could give us a brief description, either now or in writing later, of your businesses in Oregon. I know you have a number of them. It isn't simply coax in the ground or up on a telephone pole. There are other things, too. I don't know if you want to do that today or you want to send us something in writing that would to allow us to understand that. And also, maybe what your potential plans are, if you have any.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, with your permission, I'd probably need to go back and do a little homework and get that back to the committee, but I'm willing to do that.
Great. Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. Colleagues, we are out of time for today. I don't want to change anyone by calling them up now. Is there anybody here who signed up to testify who cannot be here on Monday next week? Because I'd take you now and we'll do it really quick. All right. I have to tell you, we have a very busy Wednesday and Thursday this week already scheduled for other things that have been long planned, and we cannot hear this bill again this week. It's a complex bill. We want to get it heard. The next possible time the four of us have been discussing this, you've seen the notes passing during the testimony, and what I was trying to figure out is when was the next time we could meet on this. So we are going to reopen the public hearing on Monday. I'm going to schedule it for a possible work session on Monday. I don't know whether we're going to get to I'm not promising we're going to get to a work session on Monday, because there may very well be amendments that have to be drafted in order to do that. We know that there are at least some amendments that we have to deal with based on the Senate recommendation. So but that's the best we can do given the timing. And we have a whole bunch of people yet to be heard, and I apologize for the fact that it's taken so long this afternoon to get there. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 611. And I want to note that we will hold over the work session that was also scheduled for today until tomorrow. Is that sufficient notice?
Yeah.
All right. And thank you. With that, the committee is adjourned.